أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله الذي أنزل على عبده الكتاب ولم يجعل له عوجا وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله مالك الملك يؤتي الملك من يشاء وينزع الملك ممن يشاء ويعز من يشاء ويذل من يشاء بيده الخير وهو على كل شيء قدير وأشهد أن سيدنا وحبيبنا وعزيزنا محمدًا صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم عبده ورسوله وإن يكاد الذين كفروا ليزلقونك بأبصارهم لما سمعوا الذكر ويقولون إنه لمجنون وما هو إلا ذكر للعالمين أما بعد Respected and beloved brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I would like to thank the moderator for his kind words in the introduction. What was said about your simple brother here is, I think, a tad bit more than what a humble brother is. We come to you this evening with, we meaning myself and Brother Afif and our families, and also there were other members of the ICIT who were here. I think most of them have returned now, but they were here in the country for a good 10 or 12 days. We came with a further publication of this tafsir that some of you may be familiar with right now, because the last volume was printed and distributed here in South Africa last year. So those of you who obtained it, I think, have a feeling for what the rest of the tafsir will develop into. Some of you may have also familiarized yourselves with this tafsir by reading the Crescent International. As every issue, this is a monthly news magazine of the global Islamic movement. It's probably the only free and independent forum for Muslims the world over to present the issues in different parts of the world. So in this news magazine, every month there is a portion of the tafsir that is being printed, and some of you may read the Crescent, and therefore you also are familiar with the direction and the quality of this tafsir. We've been speaking about tafsir now for the past almost 2 weeks here in this part of the world. And I will try this evening to add to the other general information that I presented to other dear brothers who we encountered in different areas of the country. A tafsir obviously is an attempt by a qualified person to write out the meanings of the ayat that were revealed to the Prophet, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him, over 14 centuries ago. That's as simple as we can put it. If we try to count the number of tafsirs in the past 14 centuries, we are probably going to count about a little over 100. That I know of. There may be, you see, the problem with Islamic literature also sometimes, there are monographs, there are tafsirs that have been written by hand. I mean, believe this or not, we're right now in the age of printing and flash print and all of this other stuff, but we still have scholars who have written many, many centuries ago, and their works have not been published. So I'm talking about the published works that we know of. It's probably in the area of 100 or a little more tafsirs in these 1400 years that have lapsed. And some of these tafsirs, it turns out, are out of print. Not all of these tafsirs are available. You may go to a well-known publisher in a well-known Islamic capital and ask for a certain tafsir, says, well, we don't have it. Well, can you obtain it for us? No, we can't obtain it for you because we can't find it. And some of these tafsirs are not ancient tafsirs. I'll give you an example. There's a mufassir at the turn of this century, meaning almost 80 or 90 years ago, who wrote a tafsir. It's called Tafsir al-Hadith. And you ask about it and you can't find it. So we Muslims in the world should be ashamed of ourselves that we cannot even regenerate some of the works that some scholars, I mean, you may not agree with everything these scholars say, and we're not supposed to agree with everything that they say. It's enough that they struggled to explain to us their understanding, qualified as they are, to explain the meanings of these ayat. If we take a look at the Quran, the ayat of the Quran, for those who do these things, because in our times, many of us are concerned with memorizing the Qur'an. No one is concerned with mentalizing the Qur'an. We send our young children to madrasas or to schools or to universities or wherever, and we want them to commit the Qur'an to their memory, which is fine. No one is trying to say you shouldn't do that. No. But very rarely do we find parents who are concerned with their children understanding the meanings of the Qur'an. And there are many ayat in the Qur'an that want us to understand it. لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَفَكَّرُونَ لِقَوْمٍ يَتَفَكَّرُونَ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَعْقِلُونَ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَفْقَهُونَ لِأُولِي الْأَلْبَابِ etc. 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 All of these are trying to convince us that we should understand what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has revealed to us. Now, I don't want to get into our contemporary problems as Muslims, because we have some Muslims who give more credibility, well, I don't want to say give more credibility, but they emphasize the hadith more than they emphasize the Quran. And that's like putting the cart in front of the horse. But it's a fact of life And we may have another day to speak to those types of people. But every Muslim in the world does not dispute the fact that the Quran is his or her number one and only reliable reference. There may be some arguments about some books of hadith, well, this is more reliable than the other, and back and forth. But there's no argument about the book of Allah. There's some book more reliable than the book of Allah or less reliable than. We know it is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Every Muslim will concede that. And if that is the case, then why can't we have those who are qualified explain to us the meanings of this book? Obviously, one of the problems are the governments in which many qualified Muslims live, to whom they are subject. They're citizens of certain countries or certain governments or certain states, and they'll know that these establishments are going to come down on them if they dare to express the truth about the meanings of this guiding book. Another problem is we have been loaded with centuries of a ritualistic approach to the Quran. This may come as a surprise to some of you, and it should, if we're not thinking about the Quran. Yeah, why not? There are in the Quran ayat. Well, first let me say this. If we wanted to generalize the Quran into segments of meanings, in which a preponderant interpretation of certain ayat overrides another understanding or interpretation of these ayat. The Quran has in it verses or ayat that speak about physical laws. Of course, the Quran is not a science book. Let's not go here to the extremes. Please don't misunderstand me. There are ayat in the Quran that orient our thinking in a scientific direction. So they deal with physical laws. There are other ayat in the Quran that deal, in their preponderant meaning, with social laws. And there are other ayat in the Quran that have been interpreted with an emphasis on fiqhi matters. If we wanted to take the number of ayat in the Quran that orient our thinking in towards or into a scientific direction, how many times in the Quran do you read as-samawati wal-ardh? Just these two words, as-samawati wal-ardh. There are ayat in the Quran about al-ma', afara'aytumu al-ma' alladhi tashrabun. أَأَنْتُمْ أَنْزَلْتُمُوهُ مِنَ الْمُزْنِ أَمْ نَحْنُ الْمُنْزِلُونَ. There are ayat in the Quran that speak about the embryo and the fetus. There are ayat in the Quran that speak about conception. There are ayat in the Quran that speak about the wind and earthquakes and hurricanes and typhoons. There are ayat in the Quran that speak about the cosmos, the galaxies, the universe. There are ayat in the Quran that speak about the air or the surface of the earth. There are ayat in the Quran that speak about the human species and the species of the jinn. And you can take the translation and the tafsir of your choice, and I challenge you to try to come up with mufassirin. They do exist, but they're not around. You're not going to go to your masjid or your public library or to an Islamic publishing house or bookstore or ever and find these tafsirs. So we simply don't have them available or readily available. Then we take a look at the ayat that more or less strictly deal with fiqhi issues such as wudu and salah and siyam and hajj and these types of matters. How many ayat in the Quran would you think have this component of meaning, in which the fuqaha and our early scholars, honorable scholars of Islam, deduced their school of thought? How many ayat would you think? I'm not surprised if no one even ever thought about this, simply because we don't think about the Quran. But if a person wanted to track these ayat in the Quran, he comes up with around 150 ayahs. But when you take a look at the Islamic bookstores and libraries, I don't want to exaggerate. I'm tempted to, but I don't want. I want to stay within my limits. The overwhelming majority of books that are written about the Quran approach it with a fiqhi mentality, with a fiqhi explanation. There's only 150 ayat in the Quran. Out of over 6,000 ayat, or 150 in all of these books about fiqh are all over the place. So that means something is wrong with us. It's all right. It's all right, brothers and sisters, to say something is wrong with us. I come across some individual Muslims here and there that at the end feel offended. How dare you say, well, yeah, I'm telling you why something is wrong with us. Why don't we have the ratio here? I'm just taking two components, thematic components in the Quran. The fiqhi ayat, let's call them, the 150 or so fiqhi ayat, and the 750 and so, let's call them scientific ayat. That's one-fifth. 150, if my math is correct, is one-fifth of 750. But this is not the balance we see in the writings and the publications and the works and the books that are all around the place. And then what adds insult to injury is that when some Muslim thinkers, they want to elaborate on what we just called the scientific ayat of the Quran. I don't like that wording, but it delivers the meaning. The scientific ayat of the Quran, when some Muslim thinkers want to explain these meanings, and people begin to point to them, accusing them that you want to subject the Quran to science. No, they don't want to subject the Quran to. There may be one or two of them who have gone off the deep edge, but the general thrust is They don't want to subject the Quran to science. What they are trying to do is they're trying to understand the scientific information that is out there and see how much that explains the meaning of the particular ayah that they are talking about. And what's wrong with that? And there may be fluctuating meanings, and we should not begin to develop a hostility among ourselves because one mufassir had, at a certain time, let's say 100 years ago, had a certain amount of scientific information available regarding, let's say, the moon, which is another, you'll find it in many ayat of the Quran, and the sun, which you will find in many ayat of the Quran. The scientific information pertaining to these two planets 100 years ago, obviously, is not what we have today. Today we have more information. With our Islamic mind, we can deduce the information that does not conflict with the meaning of the ayah, and therefore subject our scientific discoveries to our scriptural revelation. And this can be done in harmony. There's no conflict here, unless science is running wild. And on a particular subject, if science runs wild, we drop it. We don't want to deal with it. If we find that there is some type of scientific theory that conflicts with the meaning of the Quran, then we have nothing to do with it. We'll wait until the human mind develops further and brings this type of theory in line with the revealed meanings that come to us from Allah in the Holy Book. That's about the... Before I leave here, the 150 ayat that have to do with the fiqhi issues that the fuqaha have extracted from the Qur'an. There is a difference of opinion. Now I'll just give you a couple of examples. We are right now about less than 10 days until we approach the month of Ramadan. May Allah accept your fasting and your good deeds in Ramadan and throughout the rest of the year. One of the ayat that has caused a little fiqhi variation of interpretation is ثُمَّ أَتِمُّ الصِّيَامَ إِلَى اللَّيْلِ, and then you maintain fasting, you complete your fast until nightfall. That's what the ayah is saying. ثُمَّ أَتِمُّ الصِّيَامَ إِلَى اللَّيْلِ. The word layl, night, is used. So our respected scholars, no one's trying to here knock one scholar or promote another. Just giving you their understanding of this. Some of our scholars came and said, well, what this means is إِلَى اللَّيْلِ, until nightfall. It means when the sun goes down, meaning Maghrib time. When the adhan of the Maghrib is called, that's the beginning of the night, so Muslims who agree with this opinion break their fast. Okay, fine. Anyone have any problem? Other scholars, fuqaha, they said no. Night is actually more than just Maghrib. Maghrib is the beginning of the diminishing of day, but it is not the onset of night. So they may wait 20 or 30 minutes after the sun goes down to break their fast. Does anyone have any problem with that? It's a legal and it's a legitimate and it's a reasonable understanding of Allah's words. If your heart is content with any one of these two understandings, then may Allah accept from you. There shouldn't be any tension among Muslims because of this. Another ayah has to do with wudu. I'm using these ayat because, you know, these are the ayat that a lot of people have made a big fuss about. There's another ayah that has to do with wudu. يا أيها الذين آمنوا, this is آية in Surah Al-Ma'idah. يا أيها الذين آمنوا إذا قمتم إلى الصلاة فاغسلوا وجوهكم وأيديكم إلى المرافق وامسحوا برؤوسكم. And then here we have وأرجلكم إلى الكعبين, and we have وأرجلكم إلى الكعبين. The ayah means, O you who are firmly committed to Allah, if you are motivated and in the movement to perform your salah, then you wash your hands up to the, you wash your face and your hands up to the elbow, and then you wipe your head and then your feet to the ankles. Now, the word "and your feet" does not have a verb directly before it. It says, "and your feet." But there are two verbs that appeared before that. One of them is wash. You wash your face and your hands and arms. And the other verb is wipe, and wipe your head. So when it came to the word "your feet," some Muslim scholars said, and they explained it, that you wash your feet. Okay, fine. If that's what you're satisfied with, you wash your feet. Does anyone have any problem with that? Others said, no, it means you wipe your feet. And they also explained it very reasonably. And so does anyone have any problems with that? But we Muslims create these problems. The type of mentality among the learned elders of Islam is to make these polarizing issues. They want you to feel that something is wrong with the other Muslim. He's not doing something right because he's not doing it exactly the way you are doing it. Whether it has to do with fasting, or whether it has to do with salah, whether with these, all these fiqh issues. They want to create bad feelings among Muslims. No, brothers and sisters, there's enough mercy in the Quran and in the wording of the ayat that are reasoned in a qualifying sense to exclude these bad feelings. Therefore, we want to put these types of learned elders of Islam out of business, so that they don't come to us and create problems from nothing. And we'd love for them to be present. I wish they were here. I don't know, there may be one or two. I don't, with all due respect, you know, I'm not trying to get personal with anyone. But I'd love to have a session with these learned elders of Islam. Have them come in the hundreds and let us discuss these matters. Why do they run away? Why do they try to boycott someone like yours truly here, who's trying to explain these issues in light of the Quran and the Sunnah? The same references they have, we have. And we shouldn't continue to be stuck in this sinkhole that we have been in for centuries now, where this type of overtly and disproportionate emphasis on trivial, now I mean trivial here, not in a derogatory sense, but insignificant reasoning among Muslim scholars. This is what has chained us from latching on to the thrust and the meanings of the Quran, so that we can begin a new tomorrow. I tell you, brothers and sisters, many of us waste our time and our life when we are domesticated into an understanding of Islam that is incapable of shedding light on our enemies. And sometimes, from now on, begin to count the lectures that you attend and how many of these lecturers are speaking about enemies. The word enemy doesn't figure into the normal presentation of the learned elders of Islam. It doesn't figure in. Say, no, we want to be peaceful. Don't bring up these issues. You want to be peace. The Quran itself, go and count the places in the Quran where the word enemy is used. لا تتخذوا عدوي وعدوكم أولياء. Don't designate my enemy. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is saying, don't designate or don't render my enemy and your enemy as your superiors or your masters or your allies or your proteges or your sponsors. All of these words fall under the meaning of awliya. Not this word friend that has been used by some translators, that has been picked up by Orientalists and by missionaries. They say, look at Muslims. They can't have Christians and Jews as their friends. That's because of the either misunderstanding or the mistranslation or both concerning just one word in the Quran, which makes us incapable of understanding that we have real enemies. Brothers and sisters, what's wrong with us opening our eyes unto the real world and realizing, hey, we really have enemies? Or else, why do we have occupations all over the Muslim world? Why can't imperialism and Zionism get the hell out of the Muslim world? Why do they invade us? Why do they steal our resources? The oil, the precious metals, what keeps the industrial world going? They speak about China, industrial power, Europe, an industrial power, the United States, an industrial power, the up-and-coming ones, the BRICS, the BRIC nations, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. All of this talk. And where do you think these industrial powers in the world are getting their energy from? And the pun is intended. Where do you think they get their energy from? We the Muslims, from you and me. They're stealing us dry. And the reason for that is because on this level, where we are here, we cannot factor into our minds the fact, a fact that is costing us so much in lives and in limbs and in loot. We are incapable of saying we have enemies. We will have turned this page when you begin to hear the learned scholars of Islam begin to speak about our common enemies. We have an internal problem, and that internal problem wants us, if at all we are to think that we have enemies, they want us to think that we, the Muslims, are our own enemies. They're saying to us, if you want to use that word, if you want to think you have enemies, then you are your enemies. And when they say you are your enemies, this is, they go back to the fiqhi inflammation that we have. And therefore, a Muslim who belongs to a certain school of thought becomes the enemy of another Muslim who belongs to another school of thought. You have this artificial animosity that is being promoted, and the real enemies, they look down and they're satisfied with this. Can we ask, if we do have enemies, who is financing these enemies? Who is giving them treasury and budgets? Where does all of this come from? Once again, it comes from our own coffers. It comes from our own resources. That is where all of this is coming from. And yes, we do have our own internal problem, but it's not me and you, the average Muslim. We go to Mecca altogether, and in Mecca, our minds and hearts are not supposed to meet. I've never been to Mecca. I'm banned from going to Mecca. But I advise every one of you who goes there, why do you feel that in Mecca itself, you remain a stranger to the other Muslim? You never really get to know the other Muslims of the world. This is supposed to be the melting pot of Muslims. But you are confined into enclaves. They talk about segregation. You got rid of racism here. And it's popping up over there in Mecca. The South Africans are in this area. The Nigerians are in that area. The Malaysians are in there. The Turks are over there. How did this happen? Where did this come from? We have segregation zones here in the Hajj. Instead of celebrating our unity in the Hajj, no, you go there, you stay among your own group of people. That's fine. If people want to stay, no one says you can't stay with your own. But who says you can't go and participate with other Muslims in their qira'ah of the Qur'an or their dhikr? Where did this come from? But this is what happens when we take the 150 ayat of the Qur'an, and for hundreds of years, we dwell on them at the expense of the rest of the over 6,000 other ayat in the Qur'an. This is what happens. This is what we get. This is what we got. If we ask ourselves, how did this happen? Just like at the Battle of Uhud, the Muslims did not win militarily. And they looked around when the dust of Uhud settled, and they looked at the Prophet and they said, "Anna hadha." How can this happen? Aren't we the Muslims? And aren't these mushriks of Mecca the enemy? And the obvious answer is yes. So how can something like this happen? How can Muslims be on the verge of defeat and the mushriks claiming victory
أن هذا؟
And the answer to that was, قل هو من عند أنفسكم. Say, Allah is telling the Prophet to say to this public inquiry, to this psychology now that expressed itself, هُوَ مِنْ عِنْدِ أَنفُسِكُمْ. It has come from your own selves. And what we have today has come from our own selves. A Shafi'i and a Hanafi should not be enemies. We had at one time this back and forth between Hanafis and Shafi'is in the Muslim world. A Hanafi would say a Shafi'i is not sure of his iman. His iman is mashkuk. Yashukku fi imane. Ask the Hanafi, why are you saying this about another Muslim? He says, well, they say, they permit themselves, the Shafi'is permit themselves to say, Ana mu'minun insha'Allah, God willing, if Allah decrees, I am a committed Muslim. On the other hand, you have the Shafi'is accusing the Hanafis of being less than true Muslims. I don't want to use the word, the boogie word, which right now is being used all over the place, the four-letter word. It's not the four-letter word that the English-speaking world speaks about. It's the four-letter word that we Muslims have. It says, you know, this is one of these hypothetical things that a lot of scholars assume. So what if I had some food that was contaminated with wine? A Shafi'i is asking another Shafi'i scholar, what if some of my food was contaminated with wine? He said, well, you can toss it to the dog or you can toss it to the Hanafi. And for those of you who may not be aware of some details here, that is because in the Hanafi school of thought, the fermentation of grape juice borders on that liquid becoming wine. It's not wine. I'm trying to make a long story short. There's a lot of details to this. But it has to do with the fermentation process. So the Shafi'i takes something like this and begins to the degree, I don't know if you've gone to some masajid, I've seen this with my own eyes in one of the biggest masajid in the Middle East, a historical masjid. You have Dhuhr Adhan has just been announced. And then you have a long line of prayer attendees, musallin, beginning their dhuhr prayers, and other Muslims, there may be 100 or 200 praying a dhuhr, and there's another 100 or 200 Muslims sitting down, not participating in the salah. When the salah is over, then they say their iqam and they begin performing their salah. You look around at this and you say, what is going on here? So you ask, why are these praying by themselves and those praying? And both of them are there at the same time. They tell you, well, one of them belongs to the Hanafi school of thought and the others belong to the Shafi'i school of thought. This is just an example. What type of excuse do these people have to violate the unity of the Muslims? When they speak about the fermentation of grape juice, which is not spoken about in this manner in the Quran, Allah clearly speaks about our unity. وَأَنَّ هَذِهِ أُمَّتُكُمْ أُمَّةً وَاحِدَةً. This ummah of yours is one ummah. Why are you showing signs and behaviors of division. Once again, because we go back to that emphasis on 150 odd ayat in the Quran that are legitimate, that are reasonable, and no one's speaking anything, astaghfirullah, against this. But it's the mentality that has locked itself in 150 ayat or so at the expense of the rest of the Quran. This is the problem. And we have establishments and we have ministries and we have governments that are feeding this. In the continent of Africa, I used to say this in the US when I wasn't in Africa, but now I'm in Africa. There's a low intensity war going on and has been going on for many years between at-tasawwuf and at-tasalluf, the Sufis and the Salafis. Anyone can deny this? It's a fact. Because of what? Why can't we get along? Hey, let's bury the hatchet. What's the big issue here that has polarized? Who cannot tolerate the other? Open your eyes. Think. Look at these, and I'm taking examples. I mean, this list can go on and on. Sunnis and Shi'is and others, all of these are in the picture. I'm just giving examples here. Is it a Sufi who cannot tolerate a Salafi? Or is it a Salafi who cannot tolerate a Sufi? In the majority of cases. Everything has its exceptions. But in the majority of cases, who turns out to be the fanatical type? And where does this fanaticism come from? Can they quote me an ayah or a hadith that substantiates fanaticism? The Prophet of Allah was open even with the kafirs for dialogue. But they were the ones who were turning fanatical against him. And Allah wasn't saying here, oh, for the sake of getting along, don't say that they are not enemies. Regardless of who the outward Muslim is, with his overemphasis on his self-centered fiqh, regardless of who he is, if he becomes a fanatic, he has stepped outside of the teachings of the Quran and the behavior of the Prophet. We don't find any of that there. There are social laws in the Quran, just like there are physical laws, social laws. An ayah in the Quran says, وَلَيَزِيدَنَّ كَثِيرًا مِّنْهُمْ مَا أُنزِلَ إِلَيْكَ مِنْ رَبِّكَ طُغْيَانًا وَكُفْرًا. Many of them here is in reference to the opponents, the adversaries, the foes, and the enemies of the Muslims. Now, can we get this straight? The Quran is speaking about enemies. And it's not speaking about historical enemies. It's not speaking about abstract enemies. It's not speaking about fairy tale enemies. It's not speaking about otherworldly enemies. It's speaking about enemies in the here and the now. And it says, وَلَيَزِيدَنَّ كَثِيرًا مِّنْهُمْ مَا أُنزِلَ إِلَيْكَ مِنْ رَبِّكَ طُغْيَانًا وَكُفْرًا. Many of these enemies are going to be exacerbated and intensify their abuse of power and their denial of Allah. Why? because of what has come down to you, because of the Quran. In today's world, taking the average Muslim who is subject to the programs of organizing Muslims, they'd say, no, don't rock the boat. You know, we want to have good relations with whom? They say, we want to have good relations with Christians and Jews. Okay, fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But don't extend that to mean we want to have good relations with imperialism and Zionism. Here's the gray area. They say Christians and Jews, and we know that we honor the Torah and the Injil, Musa and Isa, alayhim as-salam. But that doesn't mean that we are going to have to tolerate, and we are going to have to suffer, and we are going to have to bleed, and we are going to have to be killed because of Zionism and imperialism. This tafsir offers you the tools to understand Allah's words when these words are referring to enemies and when these words are referring to friends. We come to you, and there are other social laws. I mean, I can't hear, unless I begin another project of explaining a full tafsir this evening. Obviously, I can't go through all of these, but you will understand. I assure you, as a brother, with all meekness, that you will understand what has been systematically and by the force of traditions omitted from the Quran. Not omitted by word, the Quran is preserved. Inna nahnu nazzalna dhikr wa inna lahu lahafidhun. Allah has guaranteed us that no one is going to be able to change not even one syllable, not one letter in this Quran. Impossible. But the meaning, here is where we are lacking. We don't grasp the original and the range of meanings that come to us from Allah Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. And this Quran, this tafsir of the Quran, helps you. It's an extended hand to try to help you overcome centuries of ignorance, centuries of unfounded traditions, centuries of fanaticism, centuries of division, centuries of Orientalism and missionaries and armies and militaries, all of them doing to us what they did, and we falling victims to our own ignorance and becoming what we are today. We are approaching the month of Ramadan, and the month of Ramadan, it is highly recommended, highly encouraged to read the Quran. And not to read the Quran like a machine or a parrot, but to read the Quran with your mind, to understand what Allah Jalla Sha'nuhu is saying. This is an opportune time to obtain this tafsir. And if you know a friend or a relative or an acquaintance who you think may potentially understand and is willing to understand the meanings of this Quran, this is the opportune time also to introduce him to something that will teach him much about Islam. whether he's a Muslim or a non-Muslim. That's another issue. The writing of this Quran was done taking into consideration that this is going to be read by Muslims and non-Muslims alike. There's a glossary, there's a breakdown of the meanings, there are footnotes, there are so many things that go into this to try to make its meanings available to you without much of a sweat. I think this is as far as I'm going to go in speaking to you this evening. There's always a follow-up to presentations like this. If you have any comments or feedback or concerns or criticism, whatever may be on your mind, please express it. We will listen to it and we will receive it with an open mind and with a brotherly attitude. Wallahu yaqulu al-haq wa huwa yahdi al-sabil. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for your patience, and I want to apologize for being late this evening. Please forgive me for that. It's something beyond me. The plan was to be here earlier. I simply could not make it earlier, but I did come as soon as I could. Don't forget us from your good dua and your sincere thoughts. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you all.
Thank you very much, Imam Muhammad Al-Athi, for conducting a purview of the Holy Quran in its correct perspective. Let's conclude our dua. Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen, Ar-Rahman, Ar-Rahim, Malik, Yawm al-Din, Iyyaka Na'budu, wa Iyyaka Nasta'in. اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين آمين ربنا آتنا في الدنيا حسنة وفي الآخرة حسنة وقنا عذاب النار ربنا ظلمنا أنفسنا وإن لم تغفر لنا وترحمنا لنكونن من الخاسرين إن الله وملائكته يصلون على النبي يا أيها الذين آمنوا صلوا عليه وسلموا تسليما اللهم صل على سيدنا محمد وعلى سيدنا محمد سلم سبحان ربك رب العزة عما يصفون وسلام على المرسلين والحمد لله رب العالمين